Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. Call the third case, 02-1809-SCR State v. James D. Crashier. Representing the defendant is Stephen P. Weiss, Assistant State Public Defender, who will argue for 20 minutes. Professor Michael Smith will be arguing for 5 here on Pro Hoc Vici. You a member of the State Bar? Thank you. You will, at the appropriate moment, be admitted for a very brief 5 minutes. And then Assistant Attorney General Larson. Mr. Weiss.
Hopefully I've got that attached correctly. It sounds right. Good afternoon, Your Honors.
It's a responsive session, Counsel.
Thanks. This case today is, in many ways, a very important case. It's an opportunity for this Court to make what I think are much needed and very meaningful changes which will bring our law concerning sentence modifications, our case law, up to date and make it relevant to the new world of truth in sentencing, which I'll refer to as TIS just for ease.
TIS 1, right?
This particular case arose under TIS 1. The arguments that I'm going to make, I think, are equally relevant to TIS 1 or TIS 2. I really don't see a distinction for the purposes of what I'll be proposing to the Court today. I think the policy concerns here and the economic stakes of what the Court's going to do in this regard have really never been higher in the area of criminal justice administration. Current new factor law developed under the old indeterminate sentencing scheme, which was in effect for nearly 100 years in Wisconsin. Under that scheme, all three branches of government shared serious portions of the responsibility for the imprisonment of criminals. The legislative branch set out the parameters of punishment. They set minimums, they set maximums. Within those ranges, the court, the judicial branch, set the particular maximum period of incarceration for each particular case. And it was the executive branch, through the parole board and through the authorities granted by the legislature to the Department of Corrections, to actually monitor the incarceration and to make contemporaneous decisions with respect to the actual time of release back to society when the Department of Corrections and the people that were in close contact with the prisoner felt release was appropriate, up to the maximum set by the judge for the penalty. The main purpose of the truth in sentencing legislation, as I see it, was to remove the executive branch from the process completely and to place 100% of the responsibility in the hands of the trial judges in the judicial branch. This vastly increased both the power of the sentencing judge and the difficulty of that judge's job. The existence of parole, the existence of the Department of Corrections powers under the indeterminate sentencing scheme gave the trial judges a real comfort zone in which to operate. That judge could sentence, and could sentence severely, with knowledge that the ultimate decision made perhaps years, perhaps decades into the future, as to when an appropriate time for release would be made by people who had contact with the prisoner at that point in the future. That's all gone now. Today, that judge, sitting at a sentencing hearing, which I know many of you have done and some of you have not, must make a decision immediately, reaching far into the future, decades, and determine at what point it would be proper, safe, appropriate to release a prisoner back into the community.
Well, Mr. Weiss, wasn't that the intent of the legislature? Certainty?
I think it was the intent of the legislature was to create certainty that the executive branch and that appointed people with no responsibility back to the electorate would not make the decision. I don't think that the legislature intended specifically to limit the elected judge, the sentencing judge's authority, to revisit that judge's own sentences. I see nothing in the history of the TIS legislation that suggests that. The main thrust was to say, well, this judge is going to sentence this person, and this judge will decide how long this person should be. And it's not going to be a situation where the judge is going to have to guess and say, if I say 22 years, well, we have a mandatory release date, and 13.7 years, and we have a parole eligibility here, and I'm guessing the parole board will really let him out in about 10. So if I mean 10, I say 22 and hope for the best. And I think that is what the main thrust and the real intent of the legislature was to do, was to eliminate that executive branch authority to release people, particularly because the executive branch was responsible to no one as far as being elected.
Where do you think the label truth in sentencing came from?
I think it came from the notion that when a judge said a number of years, that number of years was purely hypothetical. It was the absolute maximum length of the sentence, and the true length of the sentence was determined, as I had mentioned, by the parole board of the Department of Corrections. So when the judge gave you a 22-year sentence, in a sense, there was no truth to that because that judge didn't know how long you were going to stay in prison. I don't think that that's conflicting in any way with allowing that judge to say, under the circumstances that confront me today, I think I'm going to sentence you to be confined in prison for 15 years, 20 years, 10 years, or whatever. I don't think that it's untrue then for that same judge to say 5 years into the future, circumstances have changed and it's no longer appropriate, necessary, or valid for you to remain incarcerated for the next 10, 15, or whatever years because of changed circumstances. And I don't see any conflict with truth in sentencing in that because it's still the elected sentencing judge who's making that decision to modify his or her own imposed sentence.
From the perspective, I mean, there are various perspectives here. There's the public perspective. There's the victim's perspective. There is the, the police officer's perspective. The defendant's perspective. Let's take the victim's perspective. If the judge sentences to 22 years and a couple of years later comes back and says, oh, I think maybe I want to make it 11 years, how is the victim going to see that?
I don't know. I can't predict how the victim would see it, but I can tell you that the victim would be advised that there was going to be a hearing before that judge, and the victim would be given an opportunity to present a position to that judge prior to that judge doing anything. So we would certainly know what the victim thinks at that moment. And in fact, one of the limits now that I'm arguing should be removed by this court is that the victim should have a say in sentence modifications. Because right now, by the case law of this court set out in my brief in the Johnson case, this court has said the victim's desire to have a sentence modified is not even information a trial judge can consider.
Counsel, what you're asking for are that the court would consider new factors. What does that do from a disparity standpoint in different sentences being given to the same people for the same crime? How will that be handled? Just on an individual judge-by-judge basis around the state?
Well, again, as I know, there's so many developments in flux guidelines.
I understand the answer would be, well, you already have factors the court can look at on the Rosado, but now you're suggesting, or some of the suggestions for would be a good time, so we would reinstitute good time. So what are your suggestions? How would this be handled?
My suggestions are, they're very simple. What we're really asking the court to do today is simply to remove the judicially created, by this court and by the Court of Appeals, limits on those instances when a trial judge, in his or her own discretion, may act to modify a sentence based on changed circumstances or new information.
What criteria do you want to put in that's going to guide me as a judge to modify my sentence?
when you say criteria, I guess there's always been two separate steps in the modification process. There's been what we call the legal threshold, which is always a question of law. Is there so-called new information or a so-called new factor, which is a legal standard that must be met? In other words, does this information fall within what this court and the Court of Appeals has defined as new information? And that's the only prong of the standard that we're talking about here today. The second part of that is once the trial judge makes the legal determination that, yes, this prisoner has presented me with so-called new information, now I will exercise my independent discretion. And in that discretion, I will either grant or deny the request for a sentence modification. So if Your Honor is asking what guidelines there are as far as the initial threshold, I would suggest that all the restrictions that have been imposed since the Hayes decision and the Fuelmi decision be removed. And there's a list of them in my brief of all the cases that have said, well, we don't consider this to be legal new information. We don't consider that to be legal new information.
Counselor,
on the other hand,
if we take your suggestion, won't we have a motion by every single incarcerated prisoner that he or she has been rehabilitated and all sorts of things, and now the trial courts are just going to be overrun?
No, certainly not. I certainly don't believe that, because that's not the case now.
Well, but right now there are parameters that are judicially created so that when a motion is made by a lawyer, he makes it within confines of those parameters. But what you're telling us is to take away the parameters. And I think my concern is somewhat underlying the Chief Justice's question when she says to you, what are the standards you would set up?
As I said, the legal standards I would set up are set out in Hayes. The reason I don't think that the trial courts are going to be significantly more inundated is because prisoners now file motions and the trial courts deny the vast number of motions based on it is not a new factor. And if they simply had to turn around and say, well, it is a new factor, but in my discretion, I'm not moved by it, I don't see much significant difference there.
But what are the factors? Suggest to us, tell me what factors should we use. Are they different for each prisoner? Are they the same?
The threshold factors?
Are they different for different prisoners? Yeah, what are, you know, we have the new factors considered under the present Rosado decision. Now, you're suggesting that the judge use some other criteria, or?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. I think
just take this case in front of us. He says a new factor is that I've been released now, I make 24 cents an hour, I could be making $10 on the outside. Is that a factor that should be used?
I think it should be, and I think that under the original intent in the Hayes case and in the Fuelmi case, which is where the new factor was created by this court, Hayes recognized that the courts have inherent authority beyond the end of their terms and without any specific time limit to revisit and modify their sentences.
Well, why wouldn't the suggestion that Justice Rogensack has, this is going to apply in many, many, many cases. Certainly, a lot of people are earning 24 cents or out doing work. This happens to be doing work for the DNR or other. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people in that same position.
And many of them do file motions. They file motions now. And the issue really then simply becomes whether the motion is denied in the judge's discretion or if the motion is denied by the judge saying, well, it's not a legal new factor. It's not going to change the number of motions. It simply changes the decisional process. And by removing the legal barrier, it allows the judge to act if the judge is so moved to do so. In other words, if a prisoner is sitting in prison today and his pro se prisoner is filing motions, he's inundating the trial courts with paperwork, he doesn't care. He's not concerned about whether the judge is going to rule that this is or isn't a new factor. And it really ultimately doesn't make any consequence to him if the judge says, legally, this is not new information, so I won't consider your motion. Or if the judge, in three lines in a return letter, order, what have you, says, I've considered your motion, and in my discretion, I deny it. And I'd go one step further, if I might.
A judge just can't say, in my discretion, I deny it. I mean, we get appeals like that on a daily basis. You have to say why and what factors you relied on to deny it and why the factor isn't persuasive.
I would beg to differ with that, Justice Rogensack. In fact, Every single case that I'm aware of concerning sentence modification that's led to a decision in the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court has been focused on the legal standard for was this a new factor. Every case referred to in my brief and the State's brief is about the legal aspect, not about the discretionary factor.
I do not disagree with that. My question goes to if we take away those legal factors and your response is, oh, well, it's no big problem for the trial court because they can just say in the exercise of my discretion, I deny it. And I put it to you, that is not how a trial judge exercises his or her discretion. They have to say why. And currently the why is it's not a new factor under case law. If we rely on Hayes and we say we're relying on the trial court's inherent authority to modify its sentences, I don't see a standard that's going to be very workable. It's pretty broad.
The workable standard is the same extremely deferential standard that the Court of Appeals uses and this Court uses in reviewing all discretionary acts of the judge. If the judge says, I have reviewed these factors, and I've thought it over, and I impose this sentence because of these reasons, and what you've told me is very nice and it's very interesting. However, in the exercise of my discretion, I don't think these factors move me to change my decision. I can tell you that I would be shocked if this Court or the Court of Appeals ever reversed a judge for stating that. And I would be shocked if I, as the appellate public defender, even brought that appeal. I might bring an appeal like I did in this case on the legal issue. But if this judge had said, quite honestly, well, I'm considering everything, and Mr. District Attorney, I'm not going to accept your invitation to rule that these are not new factors, and I've thought it all over, and I'm not going to change the sentence, I wouldn't have appealed this case. And many of my colleagues wouldn't have appealed those cases. So I just have to disagree. I mean, the Court of Appeals, Justice Rosenczak, only issues meritorious opinions on the merits of appeals in 900 cases a year.
Well, I know. I sat there for
I understand
years.
That. That's why I'm speaking to you with the understanding that you know that. But to answer your question, in terms of the inundation of the courts, I just don't see it. And I don't think the numbers and the statistics actually bear out this floodgate approach.
Let me put another question to you, Counsel, that bothers me. And we're not talking about it really in this case. But in TIS 2, we have 973, 195, parent 1R, parent B, which permits a trial court to review a sentence after a particular amount of time has passed. Now, that's not – this invitation that you're giving us is much broader than that. Should we consider at all the legislature's statement in TIS 2 as we look on your request?
No.
Why not?
Because, as I've pointed out in the brief, and it was just touched upon in this case, that it's certainly my opinion, and I believe it's the opinion of the amici as well, that 973.195, the legislative enactment allowing for what they call a sentence adjustment after 75 or 85% of the sentence has been served, and if the prosecution does not object to even getting it before the judge. There's a veto power provision in there for the prosecutor. That is in no way specifically the same, and it's been stated in the Champion case and in these other cases. I know you were involved in the Champion panel in the Court of Appeals, that that is a separate, independent proceeding that was in no way meant to overlap with new factor case law. So that's the short answer, and I know Professor Smith is going to be addressing some of that because that was their concern in getting involved in the case.
Thank you.
Could I ask you, on the inherent authority that you say the court has, are there any time considerations as to how quickly or how late motions have to be made?
This court, in Hayes and in all of the subsequent cases, made it very clear that it was an inherent power of the court to do that at any time in the court's discretion. That's specifically set forth in Fuelmi. It's set forth in the Jones case. I don't have the cites right in front of me, but I can certainly provide the chapter and verse.
As I read the Hayes case, there was a discussion of 90 days.
Yes, there was. In the subsequent case, in Fuelmi, specifically, which was the next major case in the development of the law of the new factors, it was specifically stated at page 580. I could just read you one sentence if that would help out. Although the time limit of 90 days within which a motion to modify sentence was approved in Hayes, this time limit has subsequently determined to be regulatory rather than jurisdictional, thus permitting modification in certain cases, after the expiration of the 90 days. And that has become part of the black letter law of the state, that the 90-day rule was purely regulatory, so a court could, in its discretion, determine that too much time had passed. In the situation we're in today, I would argue for almost the opposite conclusion and say there are remedies such as in 973.19 or 809.30 that would allow for a sentencing motion to be made shortly after the sentence is imposed on the basis of simple objective severity. But if we're going to do anything meaningful here, as far as dealing with 10 and 20 years into the future, and this is a real problem and a real situation, that's when the judge must be allowed to act. I have some examples. What about the situation where a judge gives somebody 20 years of confinement time for a horrible crime? 3 years into that, he breaks his neck in a fall, and he's quadriplegic. So now we keep that person in prison as a quadriplegic for the next 18 years, because the way the law stands right now, Your Honors, there is not any way legally to release that person from prison. The trial judge can't do it under your case law because medical conditions are not new factors. He does not fit into any of the legislature's very limited sentence adjustment or health and aging and infirmity because he's not suffering from a fatal condition. And the judge can't do it, and there is no parole board, and DOC can't do a special release. So we have to right now legally keep that person for another 17 years.
About the governor?
Perhaps an executive pardon. I guess that's a possibility for commutation. That's the one avenue that's open. But it just seems to me that we gain nothing and we lose so much by tying the hands of our trial judges to act in appropriate cases. I mean, we're trusting these judges now to set exact terms in prison, and at the same time we're telling them no matter what changes 10, 20, 30 years into the future, you're stuck with that, and no matter how much it's bothering you, you can't fix it and you can't change it. My red light is on.
If I may.
Prosecutor.
If I were sent to the big house at Wapan, and this is during TIS-1, and I had a stroke, could they take me to the hospital?
Yes.
Would the hospital be considered a precinct of the prison?
Yes. You would still be in custody for escape purposes?
Well, okay. Is there any law that says they couldn't keep me at the hospital for quite a while?
No.
Could they keep me in some other place where I was taken care of? And would that be a precinct of the prison?
I suppose that would depend on where the place was and how it worked out. If you were under guard. And I mean, in the hospital, I know for a fact that UW Hospital, where prisoners are taken, they have a separate ward with pre-staffed by corrections guards where the prisoners are treated. And I know that at the cost to the DOC of hospital bed time, they're not keeping him there any longer than is absolutely necessary. Now, I don't know in terms of how hypothetical
someone who is put on work release from a minimum security facility, are they in a precinct of the prison when they're out working?
If they're released from the prison, I believe they are, yes.
Could there be house arrest?
No.
Why not?
Because I believe the statutes specifically have conditions when house arrest or electronic monitoring, as we call it generally, can be used, and there is no such authority to do that within truth in sentencing or within the prison sentence. That can only occur during jail sentences. Legislatively?
If I had a stroke and was put under house arrest, who would object?
It would be illegal. I'm not sure I understand the question. Perhaps the victim, perhaps the prosecutor, perhaps the Department of Corrections. Anybody could. It wouldn't be a lawful disposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Weiss, do you agree with the admission of Professor Smith for purposes of an oral argument?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Did you want me to say anything further, or I don't know what the normal custom is? I can introduce him more formally, if you prefer.
I'll ask him if he's in good standing in New York.
That's my understanding is that he is, and he's on the faculty of the law school here, and he's also in association with Professors Dickey and Schultz, who are both well known to the court, I'm sure.
I recognize Professor Smith.
Well, thank you for recognizing me. My apologies for not being a member of your bar. I'm an inactive member of the New York State Bar, obviously. But I'm very glad to be here. I have a very limited mission. I want to do two things, I think. One is, I'm a little concerned about the legislative history and legislative intent attached to it that is presented in the state's brief. Because I don't, myself, see evidence of a legislative intent to freeze new factor law, for example.
Professor, may I ask you to please speak up? Because
I'm sorry.
I want to make sure I hear everything.
I don't... wait a minute. Sorry. They don't teach us this in New York. I don't see any evidence in the legislative history cited by the state that would support the conclusion that the TIS legislation was designed to freeze new factor law as of December 1999, nor that it was intended to reverse Hayes. Seems to me the law of the state remains after TIS, that a court has continuing jurisdiction to correct an unjust sentence, and that the law generated after Hayes, in particular Rosado, is still good law and serves the current context as well as the past. Now, the contextual nature of the new factor law seems to me to be important. It's really been developed to regulate the border between the sentencing courts and the parole board. It's necessary to do that. The law developed to do that. With the vanishing of that border, it seems to me it's important to revisit that law. Not that it all ought to be abandoned, but that it needs to be examined in light of the current context.
Well, so if we re-examine it and then we ask the co-counsel the question of the criteria or the standards,
yes.
What is your suggestion?
Well, my suggestion would be, and it's laid out in the brief, but the suggestion is that the new factor test expressed in Rosado, coupled with a piece of McCleary, serves just fine. Now, I'll explain that coupling point. But it seems to me that Hayes was right in saying that it's inappropriate for a trial court to modify a sentence without some new factor being found. Makes perfectly good sense. And the question then is, well, is it open-ended? Is anything admissible as a new factor? Answer, no, of course. Now, Rosado tells us it has to be highly relevant to the sentence. Right? It would be foolish to modify a sentence on the discovery of a new factor, that is, a fact or set of facts that had no relevance to the selection of the sentence imposed. But to say that it has high relevance might not be sufficient. My view isn't that it's important to ask the question, that is, the test ought to include, whether or not the factor is of a kind that renders the original sentence noncompliant with McCleary. That is, McCleary requires that the sentence be a reasoned sentence with a reasoned explanation given for it, grounded in relevant facts found by that trial court at sentencing. Now, if a fact on which the sentencing court relied, or a set of facts, or an inference drawn from them, is no longer supportable in light of a new fact brought to its attention, it seems to me, yes, the court certainly should consider modification and should modify if there is another sentence to which a reasoned explanation in light of all the facts can be attached that is more plausible. And that's the test that we lay out in the brief and that we recommend to you. Because it seems to me that if we try and live with the existing new factor law in its elaboration, frozen in December 1999, We have really gutted Hayes, because trial courts aren't then in a position, when they're confronted with facts that are highly relevant in that sense, to amend them. I hope that answers the question of what the test I think would be, that would be useful to you for new factor under these conditions.
Well, I have a little problem here. You talk about, you get back to McCleary and
yes.
fact-finding, and as I recall, not that this is necessarily dispositive, but the Criminal Penalties Study Committee specifically rejected this fact-finding sort of thing. So why should we?
Well, but it didn't deal with McCleary's requirements of fact-finding.
It didn't deal with what?
It didn't deal with McCleary's requirement of fact-finding. It's true that Professor Dickey and I advanced a proposal which had quite a bit of support on the committee, but in the end lost in a vote. That's true. But that really doesn't deal, I think, with McCleary's requirement that sentences be reasoned, their explanations be reasoned, that the explanation be grounded in facts that are relevant. And indeed, the reference in de facto law to facts highly relevant to the sentence seems to be to tie directly to McCleary's requirement that they be based on fact found.
Chief, may I? Go ahead. In looking at the Criminal Penalties Study Committee, I note that the chair of the committee, Judge Barlin, writes of you, Professor Michael Smith, who is a research genius and specialist in criminal sentencing.
There's that fact-finding going all shot, isn't it?
That's right. That's what he wrote about you in thanking you. So you've got a lot to live up to, Mr.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Judge Barlin.
Say that when they're going to disagree with you.
That's right. I like Justice Wilcox, I sense in his questioning, needs some real benchmarks as to what is considered appropriate in exercising discretion to modify sentence. If I look at the bench book right now, boy, I can rattle them off. This is, but this isn't. You say Rosado, and that's certainly where you should have been your second oral argument. I was talking about Rosado already. it's on my mind. that's, you know, a start, but then where do we go from there? I know you talk about reasoned explanation, reasoned sentence based on facts found.
Well, yes.
That seems almost amorphous. I like more black and white.
Let me really try two ideas. I mean, one is that, yes, a bench book can contain a set of black letter rules like that, and they are terribly useful for traffic control and monitoring the workload of the court and keeping the court on the right side of the border when we have a world in which the business is being shared with a parole board. And the rationale for most of those rules, not all of them, but for most of them, it seems to me, is embedded in the old world of divided responsibility in just the way that suggests to me, that I suggest to you, requires revisiting because those rules may no longer be appropriate in the current context. Having said that, right, the question then becomes, I think you're asking, well then what sort of rationale would there be for limits to be imposed in this world? And I am saying, I think, that I don't have black letter rules for that. I don't think it's my place, actually, to be suggesting them, that they are properly, if they're to be used, they're properly to be drawn from the case law and the development of a common law. I have no idea if there are going to be a lot of such black letter rules. But I do think that sentencing entrusted to trial courts for good reason is entrusted to them under McCleary because they're in a position to make the judgment about what sentence would serve the objectives for which they have the power to sentence, given the facts of the case presented to them. That's why relevant facts are to be found. Just as a sentence, a court on a motion to modify sentence has to ask the question, is this fact or a new or set of facts highly relevant to the sentence, the selection of sentence that I made originally. To me, they're therefore very much the same, and part of the principle that might guide you in new factor law of the new world would be that sentences need to start complying with McCleary, and where new facts are proven that bring it out of compliance with McCleary, they ought to be modified.
So you don't want to give us any new factors. I think that's what we're looking for.
I know.
Standard or criteria. And the reason for that is there has to be some, quote, consistency between the courts. There has to be, because if Judge A up in Wausau does this and Judge B in Milwaukee does this, and it's for different reasons, but it's the same offense, basically the same, that's what concerns me.
Well, I think that's a fair concern. I guess, though, that I think that if courts comply with McCleary, and they do reason to their sentences, they do explain what facts are giving rise to the inferences that are being used to craft the sentence, then it seems to be that it works fine. If this new fact is highly relevant and it takes away the plausibility of the McCleary explanation.
Let me tell you how I read your brief. I read it that you would apply Rosato, which is that as to the facts to be proved, they would have to be in existence at the first sentencing but not known, which Rosato says, or they occur after the sentencing. Essentially, that's what Rosato says. I mean, give or take a little.
Right.
That's close enough for our work today.
Yes, it is.
All right. So if it doesn't fit in that, he's a goner.
Right.
All right. That's no different than the old rules.
Right.
My understanding is that what you have to do is look at all of the cases that encrust doctrine on Rosato that have said, well, this will do it and that won't, and this is good enough and that's not, even if it fits under these two factors. And your theory, if I understood your brief, was that these encrustations, one, might not have been in keeping with the ABA standards, which we, in effect, adopted, or, two, they fit the time where you had a parole board. Now you have to look at them under this new world of TIS and decide if it fits under Rosato, does it matter in sentencing, just as if you had those factors at the original sentencing, would you have taken them into account under McCleary, and how would you have come out?
That would be a bit more open-ended than I think necessary, but yes,
that's why I'm okay.
That would be okay.
I know. Certainly. So how do you close my open-ended?
Let me try. I mean, it seems to me very difficult to do if judges don't comply with McCleary at sentencing. If they do comply with McCleary at sentencing, and you can see in the transcripts of motions to modify being heard, judges scrambling around trying to reconstruct their reasoning at sentence, right? So without that reasoning being available, very difficult to form a, right? But if it is available, it seems to me it's important for the trial court to ask whether the newly presented fact changes the plausibility of the sentence grounded in the facts that were found relevant to begin with.
So you're tying it down and saying, look at what the trial judge did at sentencing. What was the theory of the sentencing? Yeah. Was it rehabilitation? What was it punishment? Yeah. Was it this, that, or the
right.
other?
And that's
and
why
then, when you get a new factor, if rehabilitation played a big role, and now the guy's been through treatment and courses and seems to have been on the right track, then you might.
You might, but I think only if the sentence was selected, because in the case I think you're thinking of, cases like that, the duration of confinement was set with reference to an expectation of how long it would take to achieve the particular treatment objective. Under those circumstances, evidence that all of the treatment has been finished or the objective, then I think that kind of evidence is relevant, highly relevant, and a trial court could, and under some circumstances should, modify the sentence. There are going to be lots of cases where that might be true, though, and there are other purposes at play. Okay? And, for example, the reformability of man, right, may not bear on the character of the particular defendant. It's important for the distinction to be made because rules that are hard rules about particular categories of facts are very hard to use where we're being serious about sentences being purposeful and trial courts imposing them or modifying them, specifying what the relationship is between that purpose, the sentence, and the facts. But they may exist. I just don't know what they are, categorical rules that would suit this world.
Well, does that raise too much discretion in the trial court so that they have no guidance?
Well, it raises no more discretion in the trial court than the original sentencing discretion, that discretion exists. And I think less because there's a requirement here of revisiting an existing set of findings and explanations. It's the explanation that's critical, isn't it? I mean, we say that in McCleary, and the same standard surely should apply to a sentence modification. I mean, you can't modify a sentence and impose a sentence that can't be given a reasoned explanation grounded in fact. So I don't think it's any different.
So you have to look at the first sentencing, see if you got new factors under Rosado, and then see how they fit with the intent of the first sentencing, the goals and objectives of that first sentence.
The reasoning of it. The reasoned explanation may be rendered inapplicable, ineffective, implausible by a new set of facts, but often will not be. I mean, many, many of the facts in the context of the cases where they were raised, which have been ruled not to be new factors, particularly those relating to rehabilitation, whatever that means, and I'm not sure, would be easily, right, dealt with by denying the motion on the grounds that they aren't relevant, really, to the sentence that was selected initially. And indeed, even if true, wouldn't change the court's view about the right sentence in this case. That's still and properly a trial court's discretionary decision.
Truth in Sentencing 2 does allow for some sentencing adjustment. Do you have any sense, Professor, of the number of petitions or motions to adjust sentence since the change in the law?
I asked and didn't get an answer to that question. I was just asking the same question myself, and I do not know. I tried to find out. I don't know.
Okay, thank you, Professor Smith, and you are no longer admitted to practice law.
Wait, good. The equipment is terrifying.
Well, thousands of dollars have been poured into it. It didn't work, Professor Smith. And so the result is we are now into this sort of archaic, not state-of-the-art, which seems to work better than our former state-of-the-art, but we will go back to state-of-art soon, and we welcome you back at that time. Assistant Attorney General Sarah Larson, representing the state of Wisconsin. Really a test to see how mechanically skilled lawyers are.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Sarah Larson, representing the state in this case. This case is about the policy determinations that the legislature made in promulgating Truth in Sentencing, and about the fact that this court should not interfere with those policy determinations. I would like to make three main points today. First, even if this court elects to adopt Crozier's proposals and overrule all prior new factor law, the results of this case would not change. Second, Crozier's proposals to modify or expand new factor law clearly contravene the legislative intent to create certainty with truth in sentencing and the legislative intent not to change new factor law. Third and finally, Crozier's policy arguments in favor of modifying new factor law must be addressed by the legislature, not this court. Turning to my first point, even if this court elects to adopt Crozier's proposals, which we're arguing that they should not, the result of this case would not change. For example, child support obligations that he proffered were new factors are not new factors, even under his new factor test. For example, they were known to Crozier at sentencing, similar to in Rosado, where the defendant knew about something and chose not to make it known at sentencing. The record in this case reveals that Crozier knew he was paying child support but did not make it known, and he made no changes to the allegedly inaccurate PSI, and that can be found in the record at 21.5 and 6. Perhaps more importantly, the child support obligations in this case did not strike at the purpose of the sentence. The purpose of the sentence was to punish Crozier and to protect the community, and that can be found in the sentencing transcript at 34 to 36. Crozier has even conceded in his post-conviction motion that the need to protect the community and the need for punishment was still there. Rehabilitative success that he may or may not have experienced cannot be new factors in this case, even in the absence of parole.
Counsel, let me just interrupt a couple things. I would assume that the trial court said that they were engaging in a sentencing to address the minimum amount of time consistent with the protection of the public, the severity of the offense, and the rehabilitative needs of the defendant. Is that or a similar phrase in the sentencing transcript as a purpose, rehabilitative needs of the defendant?
That's correct. Rehabilitative needs were considered as they are required to be considered under McCleary. However, that was not the main purpose of the sentence.
Let me tell you an area that bothers me, and there are a couple. One is the argument regarding inherent power. One of the objectives of truth in sentencing was the legislature wanted to give more sentencing discretion to the judiciary, thereby holding it more accountable to the public in contrast with the parole board, which functioned out of the public view. And so I see as one of the objectives of the legislation to give more discretion to the judiciary. And I believe, and well I do, in the inherent power of the judiciary. That is power that drives from the essence of the position. And you, on behalf of the state, also think that the court has inherent power in sentencing and in sentence modification. Is that correct or is that incorrect? That's your position.
That's correct. That we do believe that the court should still have inherent authority. And we also believe...
Inherent power.
Inherent, correct.
Yeah. Now, and that's what I understood both parties were saying, that the court, acknowledging the court has inherent power in sentencing. So if I have inherent power, which emanates as from the essence of my position as a judge, it gets into separation of power issues, I guess, but how can that be circumscribed if it's truly inherent power, which emanates from the essence?
Well, the answer to that is that the legislature has placed parameters on the inherent authority that the sentencing court does have, and the legislature has done that through truth in sentencing as well.
Maybe I'm just wrong, but it seems to me that you should be arguing that the court doesn't have inherent authority and inherent power, because it seems to me once you acknowledge that the court has inherent power, then any circumscription is a matter of grace. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just too much into inherent power.
Well, as this court said in the Cedergord case, which is a 1997 case, sentencing is a matter of legislative policy, and the legislature can decide to what degree the court's discretion should be limited. And, in fact, the courts never had inherent authority to do sentence modifications prior to Hayes.
So you're really saying that the legislature can determine to what degree the inherent power of the court can be limited?
That's what I'm saying. And the legislature could have chosen to just totally abolish all new factor law, and we're not arguing that that should be the case. We're just arguing that the legislature intended in Truth in Sentencing to leave prior new factor law as it is and not expand it any further or not abolish it and not remove all the restrictions as Crozier is suggesting.
I follow up because I'm not clear on this inherent power either. The statutes provide for mandatory life imprisonment for first-degree intentional homicide. Is there any inherent power on the part of the judiciary to impose a different sentence from the one that the legislature established?
In the case of a life sentence, no, because the legislature has said that that person is going to be serving a life sentence. And with the abolition of parole, the legislature also said this person will never get out of prison in a life sentence.
Let's sort of, for the sake of assumption, when the legislature passed Truth in Sentencing 1, they more or less kept in place the case law on sentencing factors. Is there anything in the legislation that prevents the court from modifying those sentencing factors over time?
Well, we are arguing that the new factor law as it stands has not been changed under Truth in Sentencing. So in other words, post-Truth in Sentencing cases still retain the prior definitions of new factors as set forth in Rosado and Hayes and all of the older cases. We're not arguing that Hayes and Rosado are not good law. The petitioner would still have to show that the new factor is highly relevant.
If I could interrupt, I believe the question is, what is it about the Truth in Sentencing statutes that circumscribes this court's ability to change the common law of new factor analysis?
There would be nothing that would circumscribe under Truth in Sentencing law. However, we are arguing that this court should not, because the legislature has clearly said the policy behind Truth in Sentencing requires certainty and requires that the new factor law should not, in fact, be changed.
There isn't anything in the Truth in Sentencing legislation that addresses sentence modification per se, is there?
Not in Truth in Sentencing 1, no. There is the limited provision that has been referred to under Truth in Sentencing 2.
Sentence adjustment.
Sentence adjustment, right. That would set forth a very limited area under which sentence modification could be allowed. But it's the state's position that even in that case, the fact that that provision exists supports the state argument that the fact that new factor law, new factors that are set forth in the statute should not be new factors under case law, because you only can qualify for those new factors if you meet all the criteria set forth in the statute.
Do you think it's fair to argue that the Truth in Sentencing legislation made the circuit courts, the parole board, and the sentencing judge all wrapped up into one?
Do I think it's fair to argue that the courts are the parole board in this case?
Well, that one of the thrusts behind Truth in Sentencing and its elimination of the parole board was to essentially make the circuit courts the parole board?
In a sense, yes, but only in the sense that circuit courts now have the authority up front to create meaningful sentences based on what they perceive as the rehabilitative needs of the offender and all of the other factors, and they can impose conditions under extended supervision and allow for the timing of when that defendant will be released into the community.
And can the circuit court modify the conditions of extended supervision?
Yes, they can. And
shouldn't they be allowed, as a matter of common law, to modify the underlying sentence?
Because truth in sentencing requires that the entire sentence in and of itself not change the length of the sentence. The extended supervision portion of it plus the initial confinement portion of it has to remain the same.
Where does it say that?
If you'll indulge me one moment, I need to find the reference.
If the legislation says specifically
that
court can't modify the full term of imprisonment or can't modify the term of confinement or can't modify extended supervision, that's one thing. Now, the legislature says no, then we get into a question maybe of the inherent power of the court to modify its sentence.
The reference that was asked was in section 302.113.
What does it say, 302.103?
Sub 9G sub F. A court may modify inmate's bifurcated sentence. And then sub 2 under that says the court shall lengthen the term of extended supervision so that the total length of the bifurcated sentence does not change. And that's if the offender is petitioning for age or infirmity-related sentence modification.
That's a limited issue.
That's a very limited provision. And again, it supports the state's view that the legislature only intended sentence modifications to be allowed in those narrow circumstances, as well as under the circumstances that have been carefully judicially developed over the course of the last 30-some years under new factor law.
Well, but does that mean that even if you would fit under the old rules of modification, they no longer apply under truth in sentencing too? So suppose I could get a case that would fit under the old rules. I know they're limited. State's argument that they're no longer in play at all because the court just can't do it.
No, in fact, the state's argument is the opposite, that if a person would fit under what has been developed as new factor law.
Could you say that again? I'm just having difficulty hearing.
If the person has qualified under all of what has been considered new factor law in the past, that person can still qualify for sentence modification. And in fact, there's a number of post-truth and sentencing cases that demonstrate this in the Court of Appeals. For example, State versus Marshall shows that inaccurate information or erroneous assumptions can still be new factors, even though in that particular case, there was no new factor found because the sentencing court did not rely on the inaccurate information. State versus Stafford also shows that if something is unknown and comes to light after sentencing, such as a psychologist conflict of interest in writing the PSI, which was indeed considered at sentencing, that can still be a new factor under post-truth and sentencing new factor law. Similarly, when part of the underlying basis of the sentence no longer exists, that also would qualify under post-truth and sentencing new factor law, and that can be seen in the State versus Houck case. And in that case, there were two sentences imposed concurrently, there was one bail jumping case and then a subsequent bail jumping case. And in the second case, the judge imposed it concurrently because it found that the first sentence was very relevant to the second sentence. And then in the first case was reversed, so that basis for the sentencing no longer existed. And the Court of Appeals said, you need to now find that a new factor and remand back to the sentencing court to see if the exercise of discretion would have changed. So there are a number of cases under truth in sentencing that show new factor law still is relevant, although narrow.
Mr. Weiss, in his brief, cites some previous cases where the court has held that something is not a new factor. And I think he throws out some horribles about illnesses or people who are aged. When we're in this truth in sentencing one period, first of all, what do you do about an extreme case of, say, illness by a prisoner? And second, if the court didn't like what you did, do we have the authority to modify the new factor rules?
Can you just clarify what you mean by if the court didn't like what you did? If the court didn't like what the offender did?
I'm in Waupun. I have a disabling stroke. What do you do to me? What is the authority that you have to treat my case?
Well, the only authority that the circuit court has is to modify based on the new factors that were previously considered new factors under old indeterminate sentencing new factor law. But it's just, rehabilitation is one of the main factors that he wants to be changed under new factor law. And a person's alleged success in rehabilitation only underscores the sound character of the sentencing decision. But there are other purposes in sentencing besides rehabilitation. And in enacting truth in sentencing, the legislature has said that maybe rehabilitation should take a back burner to some of the other factors, such as punishment of the offender and incapacitation or protection of the public.
Counsel, you previously, just moments ago, made reference to 302.113, the provisions that deal with the terminal condition adjustment in truth in sentencing.
That's correct.
And would that be a response to Justice Prosser's question if he had a stroke and in prison? How does what you just previously cited under 302 fit in, if at all, to Justice Prosser's inquiry?
My reading of 302.113 is that it's very limited. It wouldn't probably not apply in the quadriplegic example, because under that provision, the legislature has determined that the inmate has to have a terminal condition, and that's defined in the statute, and would not actually cover the instance that Justice Prosser was describing.
There's also an age-based criteria there.
That's correct.
If the stroke person was a 60 inmate over 60 and has served 10 years, or an inmate over 65 and has served 5 years, that would fit in also.
That's correct, under 302.113 sub 9G.
Does this 302, is that TIS 1 or TIS 2 legislation?
302.113 is TIS 2 legislation, but the legislators actually indicated that that provision would apply to TIS 1 inmates. In contrast to the sentence adjustment provision under 973.195, in which the legislature did not make that indication.
Is it fair, from your perspective, to say that question is an open question?
That case is currently before the Court of Appeals right now in State versus Stanklift. So yes, it is an open question as to whether the sentence adjustment provision does apply to TIS 1 inmates, and the state's position is that it should not. It presents a number of practical problems, and it also, the clear legislative language shows that it should not apply to TIS 1 inmates. But that's the Stenklift case.
It's my understanding that your basic argument is that while there isn't anything in the TIS 1 or TIS 2 legislation that explicitly governs sentence modification or restricts this court's authority to modify sentence modification law at common law, it's there, such a restriction is there implicitly by virtue of the purpose behind the truth in sentencing legislation generally, and more implicitly behind the fact that the legislature has enacted certain very limited sentence adjustment or modification statutes. Is that a fair summary of what you're arguing?
That is indeed our position, and also the fact that the expansion of the new factor law would undermine the certainty that the legislature intended, and as several of the justices have pointed out, would open the floodgates to a lot of litigation about what would be considered new factors and what would not, because now if that were all gone, defendants could come back with any little thing and say, well, this is a new factor, and that would all have to be litigated again, whereas now we already have parameters in place under the common law that demonstrate, that tell counsel and defendants what is and what is not new factors under the old law.
You know, I respond that if someone's going to circumscribe my inherent authority or try to, they should probably try to do it explicitly rather than reading between the lines someplace. How do you respond to that if your argument is dependent upon an implicit understanding that that's what the legislature is trying to do?
Well, I would respond that this, in the State versus Champion case, the very same arguments were made to the Court of Appeals. And the State's position is that Champion is still good law and that this court did not take review in that case. And so, therefore, this court should abide by that precedent because Crozier has not given any compelling reasons to overrule that case.
Well, let's see if I can summarize your position, at least from one perspective. TIS increases the discretion of the trial court, gives more power to the trial court, takes it away from the parole board. TIS did not get rid of the inherent power of the courts in the sentencing area, which means modification too. But TIS says, in effect, your inherent power is limited only to the old rules about modification, and you can't change the old rules on modification to develop them further. You're stuck with the old rules until the legislature changes TIS.
That's correct. That would be a fair summary of what we're arguing here. But I might point out that
and you don't find any of this in a specific provision. You're reading this from the penumbra of the statute.
If you consider the committee report a penumbra, then yes.
Pardon me?
If the committee, I'm basing my argument on what the Court of Appeals stated in Champion was the legislative intent, and as well as
I have a little problem with that. That isn't not even a committee. It may have been appointed by the legislature. I don't remember if their legislator was on. But it's not even a committee of the legislature. I'm sure that the legislature, I'm not sure. They might have considered it. They took some things. They didn't take other things. That's really extrinsic matters, this kind of report. I mean, it's more than even a legislative committee. It's extrinsic to the extrinsic. So you have to find not only ambiguity, but then you got to be able to be willing to look at that kind of extrinsic stuff, which may be good and it may not be good. So you're relying on this kind of extrinsic evidence, is that it?
We're relying on the Criminal Penalty Studies Committee report because the legislature said in TIS 1 that committees should be created from members of all three branches of and all from the public. And TIS 1 charged this committee with developing the new legislation under TIS 2.
But you're aware of the big fight on how you interpret legislation and to what extent you look at extrinsic sources. And so, committee reports of the legislature are difficult to look at because people put things in it that may or may not represent what the committee as a whole does and this committee voted, et cetera. But that's what you're asking this court to rely on.
That and the fact that I think it would be unreasonable, to paraphrase Champion, it would be unreasonable that the legislature would intend to provide certainty with truth in sentencing and then permit the courts to undo that certainty in sentence and modification proposed by Crozier. So in other words, the state of the law as it stands now provides the narrowness and certainty that the legislature intended, that the defendant would serve 100% of the confinement that was imposed by the judge. And to allow any which thing to be considered new factors, that would completely contravene the legislative intent.
Can you think of anything that would constitute a new factor under present new factor law as it's developed post-Rosado?
Well, I mentioned a few of the cases that have been considered post-truth in sentencing, such as the factors that are new factors would include inaccurate information that was relied on during sentencing or...
Well, inaccurate information is something separate. It's sort of a separate species of the law. That's not typically analyzed under new factor analysis. If the judge was sentencing based upon incorrect information, then that's going to go back. I'm talking about specific new factor sentence modification motions.
You have the conflict.
I'm trying to think of something that meets that test.
Conflict of interest is one you mentioned.
Correct. There was a conflict of interest in the person who was writing information that was relied on in the PSI in imposing a sentence, and that was considered to be a new factor. But you're right, it's very narrow what is considered a new factor, and there aren't a lot of cases that have come up through the years that find new factors. But the legislature has said that that's okay, and that's the way they want it. They do not want to change new factor law, and their intent was not to change new factor law.
And we can't change it either. It's frozen.
Well, we would argue that you could, but you should not.
Okay. That's a different argument.
That makes me feel better.
And that was my goal.
So I have already made my first 2 points, and going to my third point, Crozier's policy arguments in favor of modifying new factor law should really be addressed by the legislature, since truth in sentencing is a legislative enactment. Whether the legislature's policy determinations are wise or unwise are not really for this court to decide. And in fact, as Justice Prosser alluded to earlier, the public and victims have a lot of cynicism with respect to the old law and the fact that offenders could be paroled at any time between a quarter and two-thirds of their sentence. And I think that truth in sentencing represents an enormous shift in policy, but that policy was made by the legislature, and this court should not interfere with that.
Counsel, I have before me an outline at a seminar that emanates from a seminar that I attended, and it's entitled Modification of Sentences, and it's an outline, and this particular presentation was done by Thomas Barlin, and he sets forth the very first thing in his outline. There are four means by which a sentence imposed under truth in sentencing may be modified. They are, and the very first one is common law sentence modification. I take it by your argument that you disagree with his premise, if it is as I stated.
Well, we would agree that the courts can still use common law new factor law to modify sentences, but the fact remains that the way that new factor law has developed, it's a very narrow remedy. But I'm not sure what the other points Professor Barlin made, but we would submit that there are other ways to ameliorate a very harsh sentences, notwithstanding the fact that Truth in Sentencing abolished parole.
What are they?
First and foremost is the fact that Truth in Sentencing does not change the fact that sentencing court can still modify sentence if it's unduly harsh or unconscionable or unconstitutional. Truth in Sentencing doesn't change that at all, and there's a whole series of other cases that discuss the unduly harsh test. We also submit that the sentencing guidelines that Truth in Sentencing 2 have set forth, although they're not binding, they do give sentencing courts guidance as to what sentences might be appropriate for similarly situated defendants with similarly situated crimes.
That doesn't have anything to do with sentence modification, though.
No, it does not.
And the unduly harsh, I know we had this in a case not too long ago, and I think maybe it was in the Crothers certification from the Court of Appeals, which this Court initially declined to accept, that the phrase that in the Court of Appeals collective determinations, they could think of nary an example of when something has in recent history has been found unduly harsh. But now, of course, we have one or two that perhaps arises. But, I mean, that's pretty slim pickings, isn't it?
That's true.
Doesn't that argument also have to be made on direct appeal? That's not...
That it's unduly harsh or unconscionable?
Yes. That sort of attack.
It can be made in a post-conviction motion as well.
Right, but if you don't make that as part of your direct appeal process, it's an argument that's gone.
That's true.
Not made 10 years later.
Right.
I see that my time has expired. If I may briefly conclude. Yes.
On page 7 of Mr. Weiss's brief, he indicates that a reduction in the maximum penalty for the crime for which the defendant was sentenced is not a new factor. Suppose someone is sentenced to the maximum extent, and during the term of confinement, the legislature reduces the penalty for the exact same offense by 50%. Is that a new factor?
Well, under the old new factor cases, it's not a new factor. And under the new cases like Torres, which is a court of appeals case, again, 973-195 does provide for a sentence adjustment in that case if the maximum penalty has been reduced, but only in the narrow circumstances which the legislature has delineated. So in other words, 973-195, to quote from Torres, that provision reflects the legislative intent to create a separate and specific statutory procedure requesting sentence reduction for the grounds listed. So the fact that that provision exists, the state submits that the court should not have inherent authority to modify on those grounds because unless the criteria in that statute have been met.
But that statute, you said, was only for TIS 2, correct? Or is that provision 1 that you say applies also to TIS 1?
Well, that's the sentence adjustment provision that's open to question right now. The state submits that it does not apply to TIS 1 inmates, but that's currently before the Court of Appeals.
Right, but if your argument is accepted by an appellate court, then that wouldn't be available in response to the question, correct?
That's correct. And in this particular case, it's not available in any case because Crozier never contended that he should fall under that provision. He never said that he should qualify.
How many confinement maximums were reduced in the TIS 2 legislation?
I don't know the answer to that for
sure.
Almost
all?
Yeah.
There, in fact, in Crozier's case, the maximum under TIS 2 was increased, but under many of the provisions, they were decreased. So in conclusion, this court should affirm Crozier's sentence, affirm Champion as good law, and hold that no expansion or modification of new factor law is warranted. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Ms. Weiss?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to begin a rebuttal by going back to the core values that this court set out in Hayes when it first recognized the inherent authority of the trial courts to revisit their own sentences. And it's very simple. The court said, within reasonable limits, we think an unjust sentence should be corrected by the trial court. It is more important to be able to settle a matter right with a little uncertainty than it is to settle it wrong irrevocably. A few years later, Chief Justice Hallows, concurring in Fuelmi, wrote, "The rule of Hayes was adopted to permit the trial judge to free his conscience of a disturbing doubt that the sentence he had given was not appropriate. He should have the power to reexamine his sentencing and modify it as his conscience dictates."
So this is for the judge's good.
Beg pardon?
So this is all for the judge's good?
I think in a large case it is good for the judges who have to sentence people in the Truth in Sentencing. I've spoken with many trial judges around the state as I've traveled the circuits doing my appeals, my post-conviction motions, and many of them expressed privately to me that they weren't that thrilled with this power and this authority and the absence of a parole board. I spoke earlier that the parole board and the DOC programs that allowed some monitoring of the situation 20 years into the future gave them a little comfort zone. So if a judge didn't have to be so precise, he said, well, maybe I'm going to give him 20 years because it's a pretty bad crime and a victim is very angry and wants a big sentence. The district attorney is insistent on a lot of time, but if indeed 20 is a little too much, well, that's going to be taken care of, and it's out of my hands, and people who are going to be near this person at 10 years into the future can make that final decision. And I think that that does give the judges some comfort in sentencing. I've never had to do a sentencing as a judge, but I'm certain that it's not that much fun, and it's a pretty big responsibility, and that responsibility is just magnified now with the Truth in Sentencing and the lack of that. I'd like to address briefly, it was coalescing in my mind, Justice Wilcox, and I think Justice Robinsack and Justice Prosser had all specifically said, well, what would a standard be for what is a new factor? And I begin, again, with the notion that I just gave you from Hayes and Fuelmi. It was intended purposely to be fairly wide open originally. And Rosato's language said, as Justice Abrahamson quoted, I won't reread it, but basically new information, either unknown because it was not in existence at the time or because it was unknowingly overlooked, that's highly relevant to sentencing. And I think that language is the starting point and should be the starting point again as we begin to redevelop the law of sentence modifications in the absence of a parole system and in the presence of Truth in Sentencing. The standard is necessarily vague because sentencing is necessarily a vague procedure. I know this court is not necessarily a tremendous fan of a federal grid-style sentencing system where we can go three boxes this way, two boxes this way, and come out with 72 years. So as long as we're going to have that much discretion at the sentencing time, only that sentencing judge really knows what was particularly important and what particular purposes the sentence serves. And as Professor Smith was saying, and it dawned on me, if the judge gave more specific reasons for the sentence, then of course what is a new factor would necessarily be tied to the judge's specific concerns. But to the extent that we want to leave discretion open as much as possible, then I think we conversely or coincidentally have to leave what is a new factor open to a large degree. I think that the limits which develop since Hayes, and Hayes had no limits. Hayes didn't even require new information. New factor test was first announced in the Fuelmi case, and I go through the history of that in my brief. And then in each succeeding case, either the Supreme Court, this Court, or the Court of Appeals chiseled a little bit more away from the broad statements in Hayes and in Fuelmi and said, well, this isn't really new information because you could take it to the parole board, and this really isn't new information because these things, look at that. And I think what we need to do now, quite honestly, as a matter of setting law for the state, for the future, maybe truth in sentencing will last 100 years like indeterminate sentencing. I don't know. I won't be here. But what we have to do now, what this court needs to do now, is realize that we're back at the beginning again. And I think this court should go back to the beginning of new factor law, back to Hayes, and add such limits as are necessary on a case-by-case basis as the law evolves and we get some experience with it. But it's just unworkable now, and my time is up unless anyone has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. To you, Mr. Weiss, to Professor Smith, and to Assistant Attorney General Larson for your excellent arguments today. And that concludes our hearing on 02-1809 Sierra State v. Crozier. We are in recess until tomorrow at 9:45. The court will convene in the conference room at 3:30.